What would Jesus do? It's like a cliche, right? But what would Jesus do about rampant corporate fraud, drug dealing, domestic violence? Would he still be a troublemaker deserving of the death penalty? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Here's one to turn your head around, reenacting the trial of Jesus with law professor Mark Osler. Our number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Jesus on death row is a subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So I get a book in the mail, and it comes from the minister at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Anchorage. It says, it's this book. It's Jesus on Death Row, The Trial of Jesus and American Capital Punishment by Mark Osler. And I pick it up and look at it, and I wonder, what is this? And there's a little note I finally find inside. It says, this guy's coming up to do our lecture series, the Caroline P. Wolforth lecture series in October. And we thought you might be interested. Boy, was he right. I was really interested. Mark Osler now joins us by digital connection from St. Paul, Minnesota, where he is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. Mark, thank you so much for making the time to be with us on the program. You ever been to Alaska before?
I have, in fact. I've been to Ketchikan and down the Southeast Arm. This trip will be my first time to Anchorage, though, and I'm really looking forward to it.
So were you a U.S. prosecuting attorney when you were in Alaska?
No. That was in Detroit, where I grew up. And if you're interested in crime, Detroit is a pretty fascinating place to work.
And still is.
It still is, yeah. So you might imagine I had an incredible variety of cases, everything from Chinese immigrant smugglers to heroin dealers. The traditional mob. It was quite a 5 years there.
Yeah. Now this business of putting Jesus on trial started when you were at Baylor and as an exercise for the students. A way of teaching law and making it come alive in people's minds is probably always looking for things like that when you're teaching law. It can really put them to sleep pretty quick.
Yeah, well, of course, criminal law, you have to try hard to make that boring. But really, it was a way to engage the community as much as anything. And where it came from is I came down from Detroit and Michigan, like Alaska, doesn't have the death penalty. And so I came into a very different environment. There was two things that immediately stood out to me. And one was that it was a very Christianized political culture, that whenever you saw an ad for a political candidate, and I moved in 2000, so I saw a lot of those, they're always wearing the cowboy hat, coming out of church with their family. It was almost like a set piece that you had to have, and talked a lot about faith. Now, at the same time, you've got that Christianized political culture. You also have the fact that in that faith, at the center of it, is a wrongful conviction. And one day I woke up, read the paper. It was reporting on an execution down in Huntsville. Talked about what the guy's last meal was, because we're pretty fascinated by that. It was in the lead, the first paragraph of the
it's
story.
It's always in there when you think about it.
Yeah.
Yep. Whenever there's, we don't have it in Alaska. In fact, it's unconstitutional in Alaska, but that doesn't stop there from being an organization here called Alaskans Against the Death Penalty. For some reason, we'll probably get into that later. But, still, this last meal, I remember from when I lived in Texas, it's always in there.
Yeah, and in fact, the website for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice crashed when Carla Faye Tucker was being executed, because so many people were trying to get to the page with her last meal. So I read this story, and then that day, that Sunday morning, I go to church, and I take communion, and I take that bread in my hand, and I realize that is the last meal, that we're celebrating the last meal of a man who knew he was condemned to be executed. And there was something so striking about that. I thought, there's a depth to this. Somehow there's a connection, and we need to do something with it. And the first thing that I did was actually do the trial of Christ under Texas law in that very church over the course of four Sundays before the congregation. And that's how this whole journey started.
That's so interesting to me because for the most part, your book, Jesus on Death Row, is put together as almost as a legal argument in some ways. I mean, it's a methodical presentation, and it's sort of relentless in drawing parallels one after another after another after another between the gospel accounts of the trial of Jesus and contemporary law. And it had my full attention by about five pages in because of those amazing parallels. But, what I wanted to ask you about just to start with is that there was a part someplace in the middle where you talk about this last meal. And I thought, this is not put logically anymore. You know, there is a central, for the sacrament of the Holy Communion, that's also a central mystery. Whether it's transubstantiation or you go back to look at what little history we have of the pre-Constantine early Christian religion, and you find this weird death cult of people who go and sit with the dead and eat. Mm-hmm. Not much is known about it because it all got sanitized in the years afterwards, but put all that aside, it's a central mystery. It's like extremely central to the entire faith and belief system, and it's so interesting that this book and this idea, which is such a powerful idea, grew out of that one powerful mystery.
Yeah, and like most mysteries, its power in part draws from something that's so familiar that for Christians, the life of Jesus is incomprehensible. We can't imagine ourselves being that forgiving, that loving of others, that deep and wise. But the point of connection we have is that he ate bread. We can eat bread. He drank wine. We can do that. And I think that's why he said, do this in memory of me. And that familiar thing spurs us to the much deeper feelings. And that's not really, at some level, very different from how we're fascinated with last meals. Because, those people on death row, there are some innocents that end up on death row, but most of them did it. They shot a police officer. They killed a baby. They did something we can never imagine doing in our entire life. But you see that picture of a cheeseburger and a Dr. Pepper and a cupcake? I know that. That's the one point of intersection that I have with that incredibly imperfect person as well.
I thought, his theory just doesn't hold someplace a little ways through the book because Jesus was railroaded. We don't railroad people anymore. We have a whole system of safeguards. The reason we have the system of law is to protect the rights of people. I myself have been on a grand jury protecting the rights of people, mostly true Bill in them, but still.
Mm-hmm.
He was railroaded. You're not disputing that.
No. And part of the underlying lesson is this, that sure, the time frame is a lot different. I mean, you have all that happening within 24 hours, the equivalent of a trial, of appeal, of habeas, of a consideration of clemency, happening incredibly quickly. But even as you speed up that time frame, you have something incredibly familiar and dangerous that's going on, which is that you have this mob of people that are propelling it forward all the time, that are calling for execution from the very start and following it from level to level. And is that, the time aspect aside, really that different than what we see in Texas, where we have elected officials as the DA who's pushing for the conviction, the judge who oversees it the first time, the appellate judges, and even the Supreme Court in Texas, which is the Court of Criminal Appeals, are all elected by people who fervently support the death penalty and watch what happens in Huntsville.
Lots.
And when we talk about the innocence cases, even in a state that's been at times much more careful than Texas, like Illinois, the stories that come up again and again are that emotion took over. Yes, over a longer period of time. But as with the wrongful execution we see in the Gospels, you have that underlying urge towards retribution that drives the whole thing forward, even though it's wrong.
So, Mark Osler, I'm curious about you personally, and you don't really tell us that much about you, but here you were a prosecuting U.S. attorney, and then you moved to teaching law. You come up with this idea at Baylor. This is a state full of Baptists down in Texas, and now mm-hmm. you're at a Catholic school, you know, in the north.
Yeah.
I notice here that you're going to go to St. Elizabeth's to do your lecture, but you'll do the sermon as well at St. Mary's on the following Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not a a minister. I'm not trained in that, but just kind of by chance, I get to do a lot of sermons. In fact, that's going to be the third sermon in 4 weeks. I'm giving one here this Sunday, and then one in Richmond, Virginia, the Sunday before I come out there. And you know, it's all stitched together. It's all a whole. I'm not a minister. I'm one of the people in the pews. I'm one of the people who sits there and has those little epiphanies that we all do. I just kind of have stumbled into some of these opportunities and have been lucky to have them. And I'm very grateful to St. Mary's and their rector for giving me the chance to preach while I'm there.
Oh,
it's a
good.
Big responsibility.
Well, yeah, it really is. And I, you know, I'm thinking the way that you handle the Gospels, I mean, it's like one of the first things I learned in my, you know, I grew up a Presbyterian, and you have to study before you're allowed to become a member.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was old enough to really have a lot of questions. And
yeah.
one of the first ones was, well, these Gospels contradict one another, let alone the stuff in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it's rife with contradictions. And in your treatment, you have a really, really unique way of dealing with these. You just say, well, they're all eyewitness accounts. Let's treat them that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
and act as if they're factual.
And frankly, you know, that comes from my experience of being a prosecutor.
Yeah.
Is that you talk to the witnesses, and they've all got slightly different stories, and you have to figure out how they all fit together. And, you know, maybe one of them's lying, and if so, you have to figure that out. But if there's a way that the picture as a whole seems to make sense, you need to go ahead and verify that and test it. And in some ways, that's what I've been doing. You know, besides the book, we've been doing the trial of Jesus in a number of places. We've done it in 9 states now. We try to focus on death penalty states, but done in Oklahoma, Austin, Texas, Boulder, Colorado, a couple times in Virginia, in Pasadena, California, before they had the vote out there, Nashville, Tennessee, at a Baptist college in Tennessee, and actually being the prosecutor of Jesus, of putting myself in that role, it's a very dark, dark place, because I'm having to try to convince this jury, the congregation, that Jesus is dangerous, that he needs to be executed. And of course, that sets the prosecutor in me against the Christian. And it's been quite an experience over the past couple of years doing that as well.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. I'm picturing this, and it takes quite a lot of imagination.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's on YouTube. You can find that a version of it. But one of the things too, Steve, is interesting. I know we're going to have people call in. They'll take questions. And my collaborator in that, my principal collaborator, who plays the defense attorney, is a woman named Jean Bishop, who is a public defender in Chicago. And she came into this area thinking hard about it when her sister was murdered by a 16-year-old. Her sister, who was pregnant, and her brother-in-law were murdered in their apartment in Winnetka, Illinois, you know, kind of a nice suburb of Chicago. And one of the questions that we often face, those of us that oppose the death penalty, is would you feel this way if it was your sister or your brother, your father or your mother? And I don't have that experience, but she does. And so that's a very powerful thing that comes into the presentation of the trial in these many places.
I think she has it easier, tell you the truth.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When I kind of came
keep
up with
reflecting
it,
on the saintly deeds of Jesus, you know, oh, just look how he healed that guy. He cut his ear off, and he goes and heals him. You know,
mm-hmm. I'm the bad guy.
You just have to keep going back to the danger to the state. Well, let's go ahead and do a call and see what happens here. You ready? Mark Osler is our guest, author of Jesus on Death Row. He'll be up in Alaska later on, well, in early next month, to talk on this subject. It kind of centers on the death penalty, and we'll go back to that in a little bit. But let's go to Don in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Well, thank you. Mark, interesting point there as far as getting emotions aroused in people. A lot of preachers, of course, rely on that, and unfortunately a lot of DAs and judges rely on getting the jury that way.
That's absolutely right.
Supposed to be. And I have sat in on some juries. I've also seen some direct verdicts, which the judge is virtually telling the jury to disregard the law, and this is the way he interprets or she interprets the law, and this is... you know, they're not telling the jury that what the prosecutor argues in closing arguments is not made under oath. And when when the DA talks first person, it makes it sound as if they were an actual witness to the crime or whatever. And it kind of turns things around as far as what the purpose of the jury is supposed to be. What they're directed to do in their orientation beforehand, and then what they're actually getting by the time they go into deliberation.
Yeah, and especially if it's someone, you know, in law school, we train people to be good at that. And you know, when I was rooting through the Gospels, trying to figure out how this fit with what was in there, one of the things that really jumped out at me is that aspect of it, an over-emotional prosecutor who was really pushing people's buttons, it's right there. It's right there in the story. Caiaphas, in fact, at the end of the trial, his witnesses are conflicting. They're telling different stories. He sends a servant girl out to find new witnesses, and you know, she finds Peter, who denies knowing Jesus. And at the end of the trial, he's so frustrated that he rips his clothing. And I remember before I was a prosecutor reading that passage and thinking it was funny, but it's not. That is a feeling that I recognize, being so frustrated because... Think about the position we put prosecutors in, that they have to look people in the eye and say, I want you to lose your freedom. And in some cases, I want you to lose your life. I want you to die. And I'm going to work towards that goal. Once someone's in that position, it's a strong emotional commitment that's very hard to be objective about or to back away from. And where when Caiaphas rips his shirt at the end, that's a representation of what's inside prosecutors many times and what you're alluding to here. And it's a dangerous thing because if that's the basis of decision, that's where we get things like innocent people being put on death row.
Activity out of it and again falls back an emotion or hatred or bias on the part of the jury and tries to get at the surface. It really wouldn't matter whether the person coming back was supposed to be a reincarnated Buddha or whoever it is, whatever any of the major beliefs and stuff that are used among all the people on this planet. Mm-hmm. And for it, the founder of such an active religion to come back and try to speak to the people and say, well, look, you're doing right over here. This is good, but I'm afraid you're off course over here, and I'm afraid he's going to get stoned right on the very first hour.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a possibility. Don, I mean, one of the things, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Don, I want to thank you for that. I think it's a great insight there.
Well, I've been around, as I told Lori a little while ago, for over 7 decades on this planet. And I think I mentioned to her also that I was telling people back in the 1950s when the Korean War was still going on that, you know, if there's so much good religion and if America was so right with all the hell, fire and brimstone that was going on, Why is it that if Christ came back teaching the basic foundations of what is in the Bible, especially the New Testament, which links to the Old Testament, why is it he'd probably be condemned? I mean, we had people even back in the 50s and 60s, even if you discount Martin Luther King Jr., you had a lot of people that were still getting killed, murdered, jailed, whatever, for basically innocent things just because they spoke their mind or spoke a truth that somebody else didn't want to hear.
Yeah, well, I was there, too. I remember. Yeah. I remember the Red Scare pretty well, Don. I remember being scared to death personally of communists that I thought they were coming into my town. I mean, that's how tangible it was to me back then. And to think that some of these people I now know are doing nothing but trying to insist on social justice, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
You know, Steve, you mentioned social justice. And one of the things I'm going to be doing at St. Mary's on Saturday, October 12th, from 11 to 2:30, is a workshop on social justice. And one of the things I really strongly believe is a problem with social justice advocacy in the United States right now is that too often we tend to talk to people who already agree with us. You know, for example, in the death penalty, I went down and spoke at a death penalty conference in Atlanta a couple years ago, and I gave my talk, and everybody thought it was great and agreed with me, and then the next guy gave his talk, and we all thought that was great, and I walked away realizing we weren't doing any good. We weren't talking to anybody who hadn't already made up their mind our way, and that's one reason that I've been trying to do this trial in death penalty states and put that out there, because it's a way to encounter people who believe in the death penalty or who haven't made up their mind and talk about it from a position of their principles, which is the Gospels, that they do share that with me, even if they disagree with me about the death penalty. And maybe if we start there and have that common conversation, we can start some movement. And that's one of the principles I'll be talking about at the workshop.
Well, you know, you go into this business of appeals. And I hadn't really thought about it procedurally. I just wondered, I figured that it was all for dramatic purposes, that basically whoever was writing the Gospels, they just wanted to have this picture of this mob and then all these officials throwing up their hands and saying, oh, all right, go ahead. And you delineate it in terms of how appeals are done today, that you, mm-hmm. that you basically, you have some kind of magistrate that you come before first. You're faced with your charge, and, you know, just why don't you run through that mm-hmm. a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that really jumped out at me is that, I'm not a theologian, and I'm also not someone who's an expert in how Roman or Jewish law is supposed to go. But I know what our modern procedure is, and what struck me is the stories it's told matches modern procedure in a lot of ways. I mean, going all the way back to the start, where you've got a paid informant, Judas, having a role in the arrest, which as a prosecutor, we often had that happening. You have a task force that's involved. You have a dynamic arrest that happened and a lot of attempts to try to get a confession out of the person who's the target. And then once they make the arrest, and this kind of just is out of place in some ways, but it totally matches our modern procedure. They take him to a former head priest named Annas and say, here are the charges against, you know, here's what we accuse him of. And Annas asks if, you know, Jesus has anything to say, and he doesn't. He remains silent, also a modern feature of our law. And that is an initial appearance. That's exactly what happens in our courts is after people are arrested. That really stuck out to me.
I don't know how many of those I've gone to, and you wait for the person to plead, and they don't. Their lawyer pleads instead. Mm-hmm. They don't even say a word.
Right.
And their lawyer told them not to say a word.
Mm-hmm. They remain mute. And that's what Christ did, which is really remarkable. Moving forward, you've got the trial, and of course there's things that we've already discussed about that. But then after that, there's three steps post-conviction that really track what we have as our post-conviction process. And the first of those is, of course, we have an appeal. Now, oddly, having convicted him, they take him to Pilate. And Pilate, you know, says, well, what did he do? And they tell him, and Pilate says, well, I don't know about this. But he doesn't disturb it because there's a high barrier there on that appeal, which is part of the modern process, too. The next thing that happens, and this is the one that really jumps out to me, is that he's sent to Herod. And Herod, historically, was a different official who had a different authority under Rome, really represented a different center of power. And in the United States, when someone is convicted and sentenced to die in a state, they have the right to petition for habeas corpus to the United States court, to the federal courts, and almost always do so. And that's part of what adds delay to many of the cases that, that people complain about. But it's a separate jurisdiction, a separate center of power. And just as Herod, puts a very high threshold before Jesus at that point, so do our courts. After that, in our system, once habeas is exhausted, the only chance that a convict has of avoiding execution is to get clemency from the governor. And what happens in the Gospels? After Herod, he goes back to Pilate, and Pilate considers clemency. You'll remember because of the tradition of the Passover festival, they're going to free a prisoner. And there's two. There's Barabbas and Jesus. And he leaves it up to the crowd and says, which one of these two men receives clemency? And, of course, they choose Barabbas.
And they give me the armed revolutionary that later on is going to take down the whole regime. Yeah, great.
Exactly.
Beautiful idea.
Yeah, it was a very unfortunate choice in retrospect. But that dynamic to have, go have an appeal, go to a separate source of authority on habeas, and then have clemency be the last step. I don't know what to make of that incredible parallel to our modern system.
Well, I'll tell you one thing you make of it, and that is to point out that by the time it gets, first off, if you look at the Supreme Court rulings on the death penalty, the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a succession of them that basically take you to a position where, as you say, there's high thresholds to be met in these appeals process. And the excuse sometimes given right in the words of the justice that wrote the opinion is, well, they can always ask for clemency. And then you point out, no, actually, that's where the mob is. And you give concrete examples of various governors, such as Bill Clinton, for instance, who did use that power and really got whiplashed by it.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, George W. Bush as well. We've seen this when he was governor of Texas. In those death penalty states, it's very rare to find a governor who's willing to take the political risk that goes with taking clemency seriously, even though it is an important part of the law.
Wow. We're speaking with Mark Osler, author of Jesus on Death Row, The Trial of Jesus and American Capital Punishment. We'll take up the issue of Mary Magdalene, which was brought up earlier, actually, on this very program by none other than Father Roy Bourgeois in a little bit. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. You know, Mark, I have to say, before we go into Mary Magdalene, which I want to wait till after the break because I know it'll take a while and we only got a couple of minutes. You've obviously been doing this for some years now. This book came out in 2009, and you were doing it before then. You must find yourself stirring up some very powerful emotions in your audience when you do this.
And very powerful emotions in myself as well. I mean, like I said, it's a dark place to go to do the trial. And I'll tell you, the thing that's most emotional is when this question comes invariably, which is, are you comparing Jesus Christ to the murderer? And the honest answer is yes. And the best defense I have for that is that it's at the invitation of Jesus himself when he said, when you visit those in prison, you visit me. He didn't say when you visit the innocent person or the political prisoner. It's those in prison that's visiting him. And that is a very tough thing to swallow. But all I can say is there it is in the Gospels.
Are you still mining those Gospels? You're still finding stuff in there? I mean, I found a big revelation for me was going to Acts. And suddenly, here's what happened afterwards. it goes blazing by really fast, but holy mackerel, there's a lot in there.
Then you go back and then everybody dies.
Yeah, right. Everybody, Stephen gets stoned, and it's just Katie bar the door. But then I went back in the Gospels and trying to go from one to the other and thinking, well, probably it's more like this one than it is like that one. I never look at it the way you did, which was, well, it's all eyewitness accounts, and they probably all have their flaws. So this is what we have to deal with. But it sounds to me as if you're still mining these four short books.
Absolutely. And every time I look, there's something else that's deeply, deeply challenging. I mean, that's the thing about the Gospels is are often said as being there for reassurance, but every time I read them, it's telling me I'm wrong about something.
Well, you know, Jesus is so evasive. That's another thing that bothered me, because early on, you know, he's always going to tell stories to people, right? Mm-hmm. When he gets to the trial phase, he didn't even bother to tell stories. He mostly just speaks in riddles and, you know, like, well, what do you think? And, you know, whatever, deflecting in every possible way.
But when you
compare that with the behavior of defendants, and all of a sudden it makes a whole other different kind of sense.
Because they're
trying to nail him.
It's consistent. Yep, absolutely. And over again, you know, those passages conclude where they're trying to trick him into something, you know, where they give him a coin and say, should people pay, or they don't give him the coin, they say, should people pay taxes? And he asks for the coin and asks his, you know, says, here's whose face is on it, Caesar. Unto Caesar, what is Caesar's? And they walk away amazed. And that happens again and again as he leaves people with riddles, kind of. And if there's a flaw in American Christianity right now, it's that we rarely walk out of church amazed or angry or confused the way that we should, the way that Jesus constantly left his audiences. And it's because we avoid the tough questions too often, the ones that tell us that we're wrong about the way we're being, the way we are, and what we believe, that make life easier. Because consistently what Christ did was make lives harder.
Not too often the public broadcasting goes into Scripture, but we're deep in it now, and we're going diving right back in when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255. Bear in mind the email, which is talk@alaskapublic.org. And if you're in Anchorage, you need to do it on a local call of 550-8422. Statewide, it's 1-800-478-8255. Guest is Mark Osler. The subject, Jesus on Death Row. So when Father Rory Bourgeois was with us, and I can still call him Father because he's been excommunicated, but it's under appeal yet. But Father Rory said, I know that Jesus favored women in the priesthood because of Mary Magdalene. And here you argue, Mark Osler, against the death penalty, and you say, look, Jesus himself personally intervened in a capital case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I don't really talk about as much in the book is my own personal beliefs and how I got there. But the story in John 8 is pretty remarkable, where you have the Pharisees saying to Christ, come and look at this legal execution. And that execution was completely legal under the Mosaic law of the adulteress. And if you remember, what he does is he says to them, you who are without sin, cast the first stone. And one by one, they drop their rocks into the ground and walk away. And he's telling them, you don't have the moral authority to take the life of one of your fellow citizens because of her sin. And that's extremely powerful. I mean, how easy would it be if we had Jesus speaking so plainly about other modern social issues? Now, he spoke pretty plainly about poverty, for example. But, you know, another one that's often paired with the death penalty, abortion, it certainly would be easier to make an argument one way or the other if we had Christ being called to where that was happening and asked to comment on it. But here with the death penalty, we have Jesus talking directly about a legal execution and saying something important about it.
You know, I'm thinking about this business of throwing stones and how when there's a lethal injection, Nobody actually has to throw the stone, and in a way, there's this denial element in it that is just absolutely palpable. And you spell it out. You say, we don't really know. There's a succession of three drugs. There's one drug is the killing drug, and one drug is the paralyzing drug, and the first drug is the sedation drug. And we don't really know the texture of that death. Is not known because they've been knocked out and rendered immobile, but we don't know what's actually happening inside. It's bursting their heart, for Pete's sake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's because of the effect of the Pavilion, the binding agent that stops them from crying out or moving.
So we don't even want to see the stone go.
No. I mean, and that protocol was developed so that it would be less painful for people to watch the execution, victims' family members primarily. But the truth is that series of drugs is illegal in Texas for euthanasia of animals because you can't tell if the animal is suffering at the time it dies. But it is still the method that they use for execution of humans.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And the other thing, one thing that I point out in the book that is striking to me is if you think about it, those three steps of the three drugs were also replicated in the killing of Christ. And he was offered wine and myrrh, which served the same function of sedatives. The binding was mechanical, of course, to the cross itself. And the death causing agent was gravity and being stabbed, and by one account.
And then they, you know, there's just an asphyxiation. I guess it would, at some point, you wouldn't be able to breathe, you know, just your fluids and so forth.
So it is odd that we've come up somehow with the same series of steps that was used in the execution of Christ.
Wow. Mark Osler, our guest, he's with us by digital connection from St. Paul, Minnesota. And Tom joins the program from Soldotna. You're on Talk of Alaska with Mark, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks. This is an interesting topic. And one of the things that I've kind of gone through as a Christian was arguing back and forth about the death penalty. And going back into the Hebrew language and the original Ten Commandments and how they were interpreted and then translated into modern English, one of the changes that they made there was it's read as thou shalt not kill. But in reality, the Hebrew was thou shalt not murder, and that was the taking of an innocent life. And so it throws a whole different perspective on the death penalty issue when it's changed by the translation.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, I like I said, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a language scholar, but I know people who are, and they've made that same point that you just made to me, and I accept that. And in fact, the Ten Commandments is not one of the reasons that I give for being against the death penalty as a Christian, but rather these other things.
Yeah, I've just done that research, and so much is put about thou shalt not kill all the time when that's not really the translation that should have been used. It should thou shalt not murder, and that is the taking of an innocent life, because when God gave the commandments, there were many reasons that somebody could be put to death. And whether that was changed after Christ or during the somewhere along that lines, all that kind of got changed. So whether it's right or not, I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's principled positions on both sides of this argument, and that's not always true. And there's certainly different readings of the Bible. You know, another one that I hear very often is, doesn't the Bible say an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? And so if someone takes a life, we take a life for a life. And the challenge to that as a Christian is that Christ directly addressed that. You say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but verily I tell you. And that's when he says to turn the other cheek. If someone takes your coat, give him your cloak also. And so that he obviously is suggesting a rejection of that retributive impulse. Now, that's a different question than the one you just raised about the Ten Commandments. And like I said, that's not the basis of what I talk about when I argue this.
And I can argue both sides of it myself too, and that's why I get kind of tied up on it. But I always came back to that, finding that the original translation was a little bit in error in that they chose the wrong word in the translation. So I'll end my comment, and thanks for the information you're giving.
Yep, appreciate your call,
Tom. Tom, that was really great, and there's translation artifacts all over the place. I kind of like the King James Version. I noticed that, Mark, you used the new Revised Standard, which is I guess they went back to primary source as much as they could on that one. So,
yeah, that's one thing about living in Waco. I was surrounded by actual biblical scholars.
Oh man, so, and they're dynamite too. They're really good.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and so that was always good advice to get about, you know, if I was stuck on a translation or if there was a dispute over it, I did have good advice about that.
Well, I remember, I go back to them from time to time, these Gospels in particular, and there was one point where I came across a book by a guy who argued that it wasn't Luke that was the first one that was written, that it was John. And he made a fairly convincing case. And if you just read John, which is the shortest one, all by itself, it really has a different feel to it than the other ones. There's a lot more, spiritual. It doesn't have all the hocus pocus in it so much.
Absolutely, yeah. It reads very differently. And one thing, too, is so you mentioned before that we're having an unusual amount of biblical talk for public radio.
Yeah.
But one thing's about the subject that we're talking about that underlies this, the death penalty, it's important to recognize that even for atheists, if you want to understand the death penalty, you do have to understand Christianity, because the majority of people who are for the death penalty are Christians. And so, a lot of people I work with on this are atheists, or they are, people of other faiths, are Jewish. And there's still the need to understand the context of religion that surrounds this, particularly in the places where it's prominent. That's not Minnesota. That's not Michigan. That's not Alaska. It is Texas and Oklahoma and, Alabama and South Carolina and Virginia.
Oh, don't be so quick to say it's not Alaska. Wait till you talk to Roger here, Mark Osler.
Okay.
Roger, you're on the air with Mark Osler.
Oh, good morning. A short comment. Jesus' death and resurrection was designed by God. It was supposed to happen. When human beings used a death penalty laws to execute a lawbreaker, we're flesh and blood. We're mere human beings. Our thinking and actions don't come near to God's thinking and actions. What happened 2,000 years ago wouldn't fly in 2013. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Roger. You. That's from White Mountain all the way out on the coast of Norton Sound.
And I think Roger makes a very good point that what is the role of God and what is the role of people, and where do we fit there? And I've got two things relating to that. And one is, here's what I think. When I read the Gospels, I think the story of Jesus is a story that was written by God, that it wasn't just random. That there's a reason that he was born into poverty, for example, that when we read about this infant in a stable, surrounded by animals and the filth that would have been there, that's for a reason. That's so that we know that great things can come from poor people. I don't think that's accidental. And I also don't think it's accidental that God crafted this life story to emphasize criminal law, to say this is a criminal defendant, someone who's sentenced to die, this is part of what human societies can do that is wrong. And I agree with Roger that we have to distinguish between God and man. But part of what I see is God revealing a story to us that has deep meaning and tells us also what is important to look at. The other thing that I'll go to is that story from John 8 again. When I rely on that, people say two things, one of which is kind of valid, which is that passage may have popped up into the gospel some 400 years later, and that may well be true. But the other thing is, well, didn't Jesus at the end say, go and sin no more? And that validates the state, doing things, maybe the next time actually executing her. And the problem I have with that is, why when you read that story do you make yourself Jesus? I mean, of all the roles that you could pick, of being the woman being stoned, of being the mob, why is it we always pick Jesus? I mean, that's the one that we're not. We are the mob. We are the people with the stones in our hands.
Everybody wants to be Jesus.
Yeah, but everybody makes themselves Jesus. And when I hear the good and intriguing and compelling point that Roger makes, those are the two responses I usually try to put out there.
Well, you know, I would have to say there are a number of places where Jesus says, look, it's just going to have to be that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he says it, you know, this fulfills the prophecies in various ways, whether they were inserted retrospectively or whatever. It's in there a number mm-hmm. of times that this was, that this was, as Roger said, this was designed by God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our guest is Mark Osler, author of Jesus on Death Row, The Trial of Jesus and American Capital Punishment. He's coming here to do his presentation early next month at St. Elizabeth's and St. Mary's and so forth. He's a law professor in Minnesota, and we'll get back with him as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The trial of that troublemaker Jesus is the subject here on Talk of Alaska. Mark Osler, a former prosecutor and law professor, is with us. He teaches law at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Jesus on Death Row is the title of the book, and the graphic is absolutely gripping. The crown of thorns is actually razor wire. It's made out of razor wire, folks. Yeah, that looks painful. That one hurts.
Yeah, I never want to touch the front of the book because I feel like my hand will get cut.
Well, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, well, I was just going to say, maybe before we go forward, I just want to put out there when and where I'm going to be speaking when I'm up there. Going to be at St. Elizabeth's on Friday, October 11th at 7 o'clock. And that's why I'm going to be talking about what we've been discussing, these ideas about Jesus Christ as a criminal defendant. And then at St. Mary's on Saturday, starting at 11 in the morning, I'm going to be doing the social advocacy workshop. And that'll go till about 2:30. And then on Sunday, October 13th, I'm going to have the opportunity to give the sermon at both the 9 and 11:30 services at St. Mary's.
Yeah, and I'm going to miss it. I won't be here for it. Yeah. So I really appreciate the chance to have this engaging discussion with a very interesting author with some ideas that I find quite enlightening. Maybe we could go through a couple of other parallels, because I didn't ever mm-hmm. dream that I tried to skip to the chase just because I was afraid otherwise we'd never get there. But now that we have, and we've discussed the death penalty and, you know, the fact that Jesus was railroaded and those really basic items, there are so many other parallels that just really, you know, just really kind of mm-hmm. blows my mind. I mean, this guy was, you know, my impression was he didn't even like going into Jerusalem because he always got in trouble when he went there.
You know, and it didn't go very well that week either.
No, and he mostly, you know, he mostly liked to hang out with his, you know, and do his teaching, you know, and hang out with those fishermen and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite stories in the whole Gospels is the one I keep coming back to. It was after the resurrection when Christ finds them and they're fishing, and they go to the shore and make breakfast. And that's the end of the story. That, you know, here you've got someone who's been unjustly executed. And if we were making a modern movie about it, if that person came back, they'd go and kill everybody who had wronged them, who was behind that. But there's something incredibly powerful about the fact that what Jesus does when he comes back is, you know, he doesn't bother about it. He doesn't go back and find Pilate. He doesn't go back and find Herod. He goes and finds them fishing, shows them how to catch more fish, and then they fry the fish up on the beach. And, you know, for people in a place like Alaska or here in Minnesota, that image is very powerful. I mean, it resonates with us, and that's part of the depth of the faith when it comes to some of these issues. You know, you're talking about some of the other parallels, and one of the ones that really jumped out at me, because I'm coming at this as a prosecutor more than anything, is the strategic arrest, the way that Jesus was arrested. When I was a prosecutor and we had an arrest warrant for somebody based on an indictment, we would wait until 6 o'clock in the morning to go get them. And the reason was that there would be less violence that way. They'd be asleep. We'd know where they were. We could go in fast and put everybody on the ground and no one would get hurt. And we could also be pretty sure where they were going to be. And that's exactly what happened in the Gospels. I mean, when I read about that arrest, and of course there ended up being some violence as the Malchus the slave has his ear lopped off by Peter, it's so familiar, the way that they planned it, the way that they waited until everybody was asleep. And Jesus even trying to keep people awake so it doesn't happen, and then it does. Why does that replicate what we do now? You know, I think like a lot of other things in the Gospels, and this is true of other faiths as well, there's these deep and eternal truths that are written into that story that even though we think that 2,000 years later we're so modern and different, we're not.
So they come in, the Jesus comes in and kisses the man, and so they know which one it is. And then there's this raid, I guess you would call it. And somehow this sword comes out of nowhere, and I don't understand this because Jesus is always, he sends his disciples out into the wilderness without anything, barely any clothes.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, but you know, it's a little more complex than that, and this is stuff
he doesn't tell them to carry swords around.
Well, actually, at the Last Supper, if you remember, two of the apostles pull out swords. And instead of Jesus saying, put those away, or what the heck are you doing with swords, he says, it is enough. Now, that's not what you expect out of Jesus.
No, I missed that one.
Yeah, and when I'm prosecuting Jesus, it's not something they read as part of the lectionary very often, but because it's so confusing. But when I'm prosecuting Jesus, I use that. You know, he knew that they had swords, and then it results in violence. And here's another wrinkle to it as well. The slave, Malchus, whose ear is lopped off, it's not just anybody's slave, it's Caiaphas's slave, the guy who ends up prosecuting Jesus at the trial. And this is the amazing thing, is when he lops off his ear, you remember everyone's heard the story of, you know, he heals the ear. And he calls the slave to him and puts the ear back. But you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't free the slave. He sends him back into Caiaphas' service repaired. I can't figure that one out. But that's part of the story too. And that's part of the deep mystery that always has to have us examining and seeking greater truths.
And it's even, you know, who's going to get hurt when the arrest comes? It's going to be the slave. I mean, what else has changed?
And that's exactly the same. I mean, just the other day I was talking to one of my friends here who served in Iraq. And was on a patrol, as many people are, where you're doing dynamic entries into homes. You don't know what's going to be inside, and you're looking for somebody that needs to be questioned about something. And, you know, somebody has to go in on point. The person who goes in first is going to be fired at first if there's someone in there. And he was telling me that, you know, you had kind of a probationary period, at least in his patrol, where it was the youngest, newest guy who did that. You know, the person who was most vulnerable, who had the least power. And it appears that's been a pretty eternal truth as well.
Your turn in the barrel. Let's go down to the Aleutians and Austin. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mark Osler, Austin.
Hey, thanks, guys. Really appreciate the conversation. I've been listening to it on and off. And it's interesting that you brought up slavery at the same time, because I was thinking about the idea of death penalty. I don't particularly like the death penalty myself. I'm a very firm Christian, and I've tried to look for theological reasons for it. I don't like it because I think too many innocent people have died. But when you look at the rest of Scripture, like things like Paul, when he writes in Romans 13, I believe, about the sword, the government not bearing the sword in vain, you know, and then you look at how Jesus didn't abolish slavery. Jesus didn't abolish the death penalty. He came and brought the gospel and then gives it to us to spread and go and make disciples. And then we see from those disciples, we see slavery ending. You know, we see the culture changing because of the gospel. You know, do you think that maybe there isn't really a theological premise to not have the death penalty, but maybe underneath conviction of the gospel, we could say, well, this is something we don't agree with?
Absolutely. And I think that's a large part of what I'm saying. I mean, Jesus didn't change anything directly, and that's because he didn't choose to have power. He chose to have influence, which is profoundly different. And as a Christian, you and I are influenced by what Christ taught. We don't live in a world that he directly changed through the manifestation of power. And that's fascinating, too. I mean, you think about the people who wielded power. You know what? Who had a lot of power? Saddam Hussein, Ceausescu in Romania. They had a lot of power, but we barely even remember them anymore, whereas we have someone from 2,000 years ago who had influence, and still it persists. And for me, I read that part of Romans, and of course I hear that from people quite a bit, too. I mean, the power of the state to wield the sword is a pretty ambiguous statement. Yeah. And to me,
you know, I want to get one more call sure. in. And, you know, I think it's important to point out letter to the Romans. And what happens right after that? He goes to Rome and gets killed.
Yeah.
That's what happens to Paul.
The state wields its sword.
Yeah, yeah, let's go to Eric in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eric.
Steve, yes, it's Eric Wolfworth. And thank you so much, Mark. It's a great show.
And I can't wait to meet you.
Whether you have a comment or a thought on what seems to be a modification now in our punishment correction attitude in this country, some greater emphasis on rehabilitation, something coming from our Attorney General on maybe modifying extra long sentences and unjust sentences, and whether or not that is something encouraging to you.
60 seconds.
It absolutely is. I think that the signals we've seen from the Department of Justice and from the Attorney General are a baby step in the right direction. I hope it's the start of a long walk.
Yeah, these presumptive sentences are frustrating, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And also jamming up our prisons.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the social cost would be worth it if it was solving a problem, but there's no evidence that it's solving a problem.
So, Eric, you still with us there, Eric?
You.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you so much for arranging for this discussion.
And I hope a lot of people show up on the night of the night marks here, the 11th and 12th, and we have a great turnout at St. Elizabeth and St. Mary's.
Well, it certainly twisted my head around the whole idea and the way that you put it, Mark. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, it's Governor Sean Parnell. Thanks so much to Minnesota Public Radio, Dave Waldron, Gloria Townsend, and Beatty Trentina. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.